Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Naturalist Capitalist. I'm coming to you from the road in Arizona, and it is hot down here. If you're also in Arizona, you would know, or pretty much anywhere in the country right now, it's hot everywhere. But on the other end, I've got my friend Dak Rouleau, who you guys who have been following me for a while would know. He and I did lots of videos last year, and we've kind of grown apart the last few months, but we're going to try to change that and do more videos again. So how you doing, Dak?
I'm as perky as a rat in liverwurst. How are you tonight, Reed?
I'm doing well because today's a holiday. It is yes. Donald Rumsfeld is still dead day.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
On your channel, you've done a lot of great videos about exposing horrible neocon and disgusting bottom dwellers that are in different administrations from, you know, that were in Obama's administration and are now back in Biden's administration. And the same happened with Trump's administration and Bush's administration. But why don't you just give us a little bit of the lowdown on what your feelings are on Rumsfeld and how do you hope his final days, final minutes were before he finally left this earth?
I'm hoping they were agonizing. You know, Rumsfeld was in the Pentagon on 9/11, and it's really a shame that the plane didn't take him out. He was, you talk about how there's this disgusting cyclical element to government rehirings, how the Biden administration is just a recycling of the Obama administration, and the Trump administration had elements of the first Bush administration. There is that same incestuous element to Donald Rumsfeld, because he served under Gerald Ford, and then he returned under George W. Bush. So yeah, I kind of came into a state of political cognizance with Rumsfeld in office. And I was just in such a good mood when I heard that that man had finally breathed his last. I did have to go down and have a few drinks because I was just, it just put me in such a giddy feeling. It was, I remember back in 06, I think it was, Jerry Falwell died. And my hero at the time, Matt Cale, wrote an article titled, "Jerry Falwell Stone Fucking Dead at Last." And that is the way I felt about Rumsfeld. Just, I wasn't as happy as I'm going to be when Dick Cheney dies. But yeah, it was, I think the reason why it was so cathartic for me was because I was down due to the death of Mike Gravel. I did a tribute video to him on my Overwritten YouTube channel. I was sad to see him go, but seeing Rumsfeld go, it did lift my spirits just a little bit.
Yeah, it was nice that it happened in the succession that it did, because it was a tragedy to lose Mike Gravel. At least he lived to a ripe old age, but I think we were all sad to see such an anti-war hero fade into the sunset. But then, yeah, it was a little bit of a dessert to have Rumsfeld go. That made it that made it a little better. So you had Mike Gravel on your show, what, two or three times? Or
Yes, I had him on twice. We talked before the New Hampshire primary last year, and then we talked about his book, which was The Failure of Representative Government and the Solution. He argues in that book that there should be no representative government, just direct democracy.
Yeah, that's something I want to talk about a little bit, because the last time I had you on, I was on the precipice of anarchism. I was thinking about jumping off the cliff and just going for it. And I did take that leap. I know you've been on a similar journey. And I think we've had similar conclusions that it's not so much that we have the solution for all the problems. We just realized that the government is not solving any of those problems. It's exacerbating most of them. So do you want to talk about how that transformation has come for you over the last year or however long? Or
yeah, if you read classical philosophy, and I've got Nietzsche on my shirt, but he was hardly the only one. There is no respectable philosopher with which I'm familiar who thought that democracy was a good idea. Plato had the famous analogy that it's 10 people on a boat rowing it in 10 different directions at once. Nietzsche had a more critical view of it, where he asked the question, if we are unable to manage our own lives and our own affairs with perfection, then what right do we think we have to tell other people how to manage their own lives and manage their own affairs? Which is a good question. You know, I can't manage my own life perfectly, so why should I be able to tell you how to live yours? And the thing of it is, in Mike Gravel's book, he talks about how we don't need these representatives in Congress. We can just take direct action ourselves to vote on the issues that are of importance to us. Well, the thing is, regardless of your political ideology, I don't see what good the government does for you. Because if you are a libertarian, you can obviously see that the government is just standing in the way. But even if you're a hardcore progressive and a leftist, you can have a socialist society without a government. Rousseau wrote quite a bit about this. He wrote in support of this collectivist kind of quasi-utopia where everybody feels exactly the same way and submits to the common rule. But he didn't say much in The Social Contract about the government per se. It's more about your obligation to the people around you. So regardless of your political bent, I haven't seen any evidence of what good the government does.
Yeah, it seems that the progressives are unable to detach themselves from government philosophy. I mean, I don't see very many progressives sporting anarcho-socialism or anarcho-communism or anything. I mean, they are still pretty hell-bent on using the government to shape the society that they want to see. And I don't know. I just can't imagine being in that position right now and still thinking that that's a viable option, that, you know, especially this government that we have now, that you could transform it into something that you think would actually facilitate your desires and your end goals. I mean, I just can't imagine it. And I think that progressivism is kind of doomed to fail as a philosophy in this country because there's no viable end result with this massive bloated government that we have that is so married to corporations and everything. I mean, I feel like they're eventually going to get red-pilled and realize, okay, this isn't going to happen. This isn't going to work.
Well, it's interesting. What I said a moment ago about Nietzsche saying that if we can't manage our own affairs, what right do we have to manage somebody else's? The progressive fallacy is to say that this government, being as dysfunctional as it is, requires even more power and dominion. You're going from the most dysfunctional government that I could possibly imagine to a full-on progressive version, which it assumes that the government will be basically perfect and unerring. And that is an audacious, they mispronounced it there, an audacious leap of logic to make. They don't see that fallacy there. But there's another issue here, which is that so much of what you see on Twitter from progressives, where they say, if we were able to spend $6 trillion on the war on terror, why can't we spend $6 trillion on healthcare? Well, yeah, it would be better to spend $6 trillion on healthcare than to spend it on the war on terror. But what they don't realize is we didn't actually have that money in the first place. Like, right. If we had spent it all on healthcare, yeah, I agree. Considering the fact that the country is $30 trillion in debt, the streets should be paved with gold and everybody should be drinking champagne for breakfast and everyone should have a PhD. But even if we did have that beautiful society, we would still be $30 trillion in debt. And so then the consequences of that kind of reckless profligate spending would eventually fall upon us. So I think that they're mistaking the iniquity of what we have spent that money on. They have mistaken that for the nature of debt itself. I mean, I think that there are some logical errors that they make there, but I think that comes from the reactionaryism that is ultimately the tenet of social media politics.
Yeah, I know you and I are going to do a video on your channel about the culture war and libertarians.
Yes.
You mentioned it. But I do want to get into that a little bit. I feel like libertarians are not winning the culture war, but they're inevitably going to win the war in a way, because it's the only possible outcome other than a government that is more authoritarian and more autocratic than what we already have. I mean, there's no way that this system is going to last. It's going to crumble. Yeah. So to me, it's really about what do we do after this system collapses? Are we going to turn to a dictator, or are we going to decentralize? You know, it's going to be one or the other.
Well, yeah, I remember saying at the time that people who wanted to talk about Tulsi Gabbard's campaign, I couldn't take them seriously if they hadn't paid attention to the Ron Paul campaign, because they wouldn't have seen how the establishment conspired against him. But the mistake I think that politicians make, mainstream politicians, the problem that they represent is they give people the impression that we can somehow fix this these problems through conventional means. Like, I mean, even Ron Paul at this point, you're not going to be able to get us out of this $30 trillion in debt just by cutting the federal budget. I mean, it's just not realistic. The inevitability of the breakdown of society, of this social structure, I very much look forward to it, which is why I subscribe to the same accelerationist program that you did. The thing is, this society is so vulnerable to the rise of a fascist who will say that he can unite the country against a common enemy. And I don't know if that common enemy would be Russia or China or something else, but that I think would just be a continuation of the failed experiment. I don't think that the country can be said to have truly collapsed if we have folded economically and surrendered to a dictator who's leading us down an increasingly destructive path. I think that means that we still have more self-destruction to undergo. But when it's over, I think that the decentralization and the hands-off approach to government is something that's going to be appealing to people, if only out of necessity, because if the government lacks the massive tax revenue that it enjoys at present, it obviously won't have the fuel to continue on its wayward course.
Right. Yeah, I think that it is going to be a choice between decentralizing more quickly or choosing a dictator, like you said. I mean, it seems like we're either going to crack down and really try to get everyone on the same page, or we're just going to say, hey, you know what, this isn't working, let's split up. So I mean, that's sort of what my goal is these days, is just to try to convince people that the split up is not a bad thing. It's been so propagandized into our minds that the worst tragedy in the world is secession or balkanization. You know, and I mean, in my opinion, the Civil War has been propagandized as though it was only a fight to abolish slavery, you know, that was the entire intent of the North. You know, when there's like so many other things playing into that war, and you know, there were, I mean, that war was about federal control at the end of it. You know, it was about preserving the Union. It didn't really have to do with getting rid of slavery. The North still had slaves. They offered the South to rejoin the Union if they'd keep their slaves. So we just have all this propaganda that dissolving the Union is the worst thing that could happen. And to me, it's actually one of the best things that could happen going forward. I mean, because the most peaceful solution to a violent relationship is a breakup. Yeah. And I think people need to start thinking that way.
Well, I think that the emphasis on slavery in our assessment of the Civil War, that's a romanticized vision of history, which is demonstrably false. I mean, Lincoln said multiple times that his mission was to preserve the Union. And two presidents before him, you had Franklin Pierce, New Hampshire's only president, who he basically took the same route that Lincoln did. It's just that he didn't have a civil war on his hands. He was trying to preserve the Union. In hindsight, which hindsight is obviously 2020, like, it's easy for us to try to criticize Lincoln and Pierce and all of the rest. But it's clear to me that in hindsight, the best thing to do would have been to allow the South to go its way. And slavery was on its way out anyway. That to me was the real failure of the South, was its inability to recognize that slavery was running out of time. You saw other nations were abolishing slavery. And so if the South had tried to dig in its heels and say, we're going to keep slavery codified, eventually other nations would have refused to do trade with them. And then through economic means alone, they would have capitulated and they would have had to probably eventually rejoin the Union. But certainly they would have had to take slavery off the books. I understand that doesn't do a whole lot of good for the slaves living at the time, but we would have avoided the social deconstruction of the South, which was never overcome. And we probably would have overcome or avoided rather a lot of these unnecessary racial tensions. And just on the subject of secession, I believe back in January, February, maybe even as late as March, we saw the mass media like MSNBC running a litany of op-eds warning about the danger of secession just because you had a few right-wingers down in Texas who wanted to secede from the Biden administration, as if that were somehow possible. And I did a video with D. Pierce SSC in which we actually defended the idea of secession. We said that it actually is a great opportunity to try to overcome some of the hyperextension that I think this government, the American federal government, needlessly subjects itself to. It tries to answer to too many cultural factions at once. And so I think reducing the scope of the federal government in this country, I think would be a very good thing.
Yeah. Are you someone who believes that boiling the water more quickly so the frog will jump out is a better approach, or do you think that there's a lid on the pot, so it doesn't matter, you can't jump out anyway? So if we're boiling the frog faster, it's dying faster. What's your thought there?
Well, I tend to subscribe to Tolstoy's view of fate, which is, although I guess I'm an atheist, I do actually believe in fate. I do believe that we have only so much control over our own personal lives, and never mind over like the political situation. There are a bunch of different factors in play simultaneously. So the idea of that we have volition as an individual, I don't know that I buy it. So I think that the pot is boiling at its own pace. Do I hope to see it finally boil over in my own lifetime? There are so many interesting historical developments taking place right now that I've just resigned myself to saying I'm okay living through this historical epic that I find myself in, and the pot will boil at its own pace. Where I see us living now is we're living at the time when the authoritarianism is boiling over, and the public, I think what's happening right now is the public is being encouraged to indulge a bloodlust, a collective lust for vengeance and control, that's why it's very interesting that Bill Cosby's development in his legal case followed right on the heels of Derek Chauvin's sentence, which did not satisfy the BLM activists. We're seeing that people are demanding blood. They want to see the villainous men vanquished on the world stage, and they're not getting what they want. And the public is being teased with the possibility of really making bad people suffer. And that, to me, is part of the pot boiling over. I also think that it's being done deliberately in advance of Kamala Harris's inevitable presidential run.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I feel like there has been pushback from the public a couple times. And one example was with vaccine passports. Those were pushed too quickly. There was no obvious reward for getting your vaccine passport. You still had to wear a mask. You still had to social distance. And then they realized, oh, we fucked this up. We need some sort of incentive here. So then they sort of rolled back the mask thing, and they rolled back social distancing thing. But it was too late, and everyone was like, no, fuck you, we're not doing these vaccine passports. Here in Arizona and in Nevada, all the signs on the doors say, if you are vaccinated, you don't need a mask. There's no one asking for a passport or proof of your vaccination anywhere. Yeah, certification of your vaccination anywhere. So that was a victory in my mind because they pushed it too hard, too fast, and people said no. Where with a lot of the other COVID stuff, it happened kind of slowly, and they scared us with a lot of information that wasn't backed up by fact completely, but I don't know. They didn't push super hard. They just they scared us with an initial propaganda of, mass death that was going to happen. And we kind of bought it. And then they didn't push really hard for anything else till the end there. And that's when people were like, no, we're done. We're not doing this. So that's why I kind of ascribe to accelerationism, because it seems to be more effective in actually waking people up and snapping them out of their trance that they're in.
I think we are living in a time of acceleration, regardless of the virtue of acceleration or what we would prefer. I think that this is the time in which we find ourselves. So I think if you're advocating for accelerationism, I would argue it's probably just your way of recognizing the reality of the world that we're living in. Like, we're seeing these authoritarian measures accelerate. And I would go even further back with COVID authoritarianism. I have a whole playlist at the Overwritten Channel called Authoritarianism in the Pandemic, mostly with my fiance Christy Doff, wherein we talk about the government's totalitarian response to this disease. It took the public a long time to become desensitized to this issue, where they had the swine flu scaremongering, they had the bird flu scaremongering, there was the peanut butter salmonella controversy. I mean, there were a million different things. So the public was subjected to these medical scaremongering exercises over and over again. And then it was with the coronavirus that they finally seemed to snap. So it is very much what you're talking about, the slow boil, where people are wade themselves into the pool. They become acclimated to it, basically. That occurs with any kind of situation that you can think of. People can develop a tolerance to things. But the question, I think, right now for accelerationism is, what is going to happen to the younger generation who are brought up in a time where this type of acceleration or this pace is the new norm? You have to think about kids who really cannot fathom a time before the internet. And we kind of live, we grew up right on the cusp of that, where I remember a time when we did not have a computer in our home, and you probably do too. But people who are just like 5 or 6 years younger than us really do not. I'm not sure that my younger brother really remembers a time without the computer. So that kind of, when we talk about accelerationism, it's good if we're anticipating the breakdown of the totalitarian structure, but we also have to be careful about the generation of sheep who are being brought up during the same, within the same climate.
Yeah. Were you surprised at all by how people took things? Cause I guess I wasn't. I mean, I think the lockdowns and the COVID acceptance lasted a little bit longer than I thought it would, but I wasn't really surprised that people kind of rolled over and took it. Cause if you look at how they did it, you're right. They kind of did prep us with all these other pandemics or whatever in the past. And then, at least the state I was in, when the lockdown started, it was all pretty voluntary at first. Like, they didn't actually force the shutdown of businesses. They just had this massive information campaign that scared people into staying in their houses. And then they had the kind of authoritarian legislation follow the fear of the people. So it was almost like an acceptance of like, oh yeah, this is reinforcing what we're already doing. This is reinforcing what we want. And then it was too late. Then you had government enforced lockdowns and all these massive bailouts and everything that the people had already kind of accepted before they were instituted. You know what I'm saying?
When you ask if I was surprised, I wasn't surprised that people capitulated to it. We saw those right-wingers who had to stand outside of the Capitol building with their guns, but then they never actually took any decisive action. I wasn't surprised that people rolled over. What I was surprised and discouraged and demoralized by was the facility with which people accepted the fear-mongering propaganda, like the extent to which people were actually terrified of the disease. I mean, it's one thing to say, hey, let's just keep our heads down and just let the government do what it will, and we'll just ride out the storm. That's one thing. But you saw people who were actually terrified of the disease. And I didn't realize that those people existed outside of the internet until I think it was probably in May of last year, so it was roughly 2 months into the lockdowns. I remember asking my neighbor if she would watch my cat while I went on vacation, and she was very much offended by the idea that I would go out and travel during this massive public health emergency. And I was a little put off by it, and I tried to make amends with her, but I could see that I had really rubbed her the wrong way by asking that, and that was shocking to me. It was really shocking to me to see somebody accept the propaganda and the fear mongering so swiftly. And I don't think she was a leftist by any means. I mean, we've seen plenty of right wingers and conservatives who are living in absolute terror of this disease. And I think that, you know, earlier we were talking about progressives. I think a big problem with progressives is they don't get out enough. They don't spend enough time off the internet. I think that there are a lot of people who claim to be red-pilled or black-pilled think that those who are afraid of the virus exist only on the internet, or just like media creations. But no, unfortunately, if you go out into the real world, you will see that there are a lot of people out there who really do think that they're living out in the modern bubonic plague or something like that. So that really depressed me to realize that people are really that gullible and afraid.
Yeah, what I think it is, I'm assuming you've read Orwell and Huxley, 1984, yep, and Brave New World. The 1984 style world is much harder to maintain because it requires so much enforcement and so much intelligence, so much surveillance, where the Brave New World universe is much easier to maintain because people do it willingly. They don't want anything else. They actually want the government to do what it's doing because it's giving them things that they want. If you give people what they want, they'll give up their rights. So that to me was what they did so successfully at the beginning. They scared the shit out of everybody so that they didn't have to force most people into doing dumb stuff. I mean, most people were just willing to do it. And then, you know, when we saw that first giant stimulus bill, the CARES Act, come through, anyone who was questioning it or trying to delay it, like Thomas Massey wanted a recorded vote, you know, they were the enemy. They were the worst people on earth for just delaying this benevolence from our government to help save us. That to me is where they really played it well. I mean, because, and that's where they screwed up with the vaccine passports. The vaccine passport was much more of a 1984 style move because it didn't seem necessary. There was no incentive. There was no reward for you if you did it the right way. It was just punishment. You can't do anything. You're going to be ostracized, basically. So to me, the Brave New World is always more effective than the 1984. What are your thoughts on that?
Brave New World is also often compared to Fahrenheit 9/11 in that Brave New World's vision of the future is more frightening because you don't have to burn books because nobody wants to read them. One thing I want to say about this COVID authoritarianism stuff is any YouTube commentator who has not spoken out in critique of the COVID authoritarianism, I will not take seriously. And I won't call any names because we know how I love to do that. But no, there are quite a few out there, including some very prominent ones with over 800,000 subscribers. You know the guy I'm talking about. And he does not talk about this, so I do not take him seriously. This is pretty much what separates the wheat from the chaff on the subject. So with this, what you're talking about with the COVID passports, that was a bit too heavy-handed of a move for the current climate. But I do think 5 years from now, people will be much more amenable to that. We saw a few other instances of overstepping. If you notice, they decided to drop the mask requirements and the social distancing requirements for vaccinated people after they said that people need to start wearing two masks. And I think the reason for that was because that propaganda didn't take off. People didn't take that seriously. And I think that there's some practical reasons for that. It's just difficult to see if someone's wearing two masks, whereas it's very easy to see if someone's wearing one. So I think they realized they were giving too much stick and they needed to actually give a carrot or else no one was going to get vaccinated. But the I think that this Delta variant that is being talked about, I think that that is laying the groundwork for what I really think is coming, which is in the future, they're going to say there is another possibility of another lockdown because of some disease. In order to prevent this, we must take drastic measures and we must repeal the First Amendment and we must all get this vaccine ahead of time. That is what I think it is. It's not so much what they're doing in response to COVID so much as they're going to use all of this as a threat in order to compel the people's obedience when they claim that there's another medical emergency that requires this type of ridiculous draconian action. Because that's the thing, is they've gone to this extent over a disease that kills less than 1% of the people it infects. What if they said that there's a disease coming out that will kill 10% of the people in it? They could come a lot of real obedience if they wanted to play that card.
Right. So whenever I see a social rift during a time like this where you see the right and the left clearly opposing each other on something, you tend to see the establishment working behind the scenes, accomplishing their true goal. So masks were very split on right and left. You know, the right was pretty anti-mask. The left was pretty pro-mask. I didn't like masks. I think masks are dumb. I don't think they accomplish anything. But I was throughout the entire catastrophe that was last year and the beginning of this year, I was focusing on where is the money going? You know, they're enriching the filth of this nation and the filth of this world at our own expense while we're arguing over face coverings. Yeah. So do you think that the mask hysteria was intentional, and that when they saw it starting to create this social rift, that they used it as a distraction to keep us from talking about the truly horrible things that were happening? And I'm not defending masks here at all. I don't like masks.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying.
I'm just saying, like, the masks were not the most important thing that was taking place in my mind. There was much more serious shit, and everyone was arguing about face coverings.
Well, the mask was kind of, I saw it as it was like a symbol of obedience. It was that if someone was wearing the mask in public, then they were indicating that they were obeying whatever requirements were in place. So it was symbolic. Obviously, I thought they were idiotic too. But the public arguing about those, it was designed to keep the public in the dark and to try to keep them ignorant about what was actually taking place. Now, what you mentioned with Wall Street, for example, and the massive bailouts to the government while the people get peanuts, this is something that has been really frustrating to me with a lot of these YouTube commentators, is that you are allowed, it seems, to complain about the government not giving enough assistance to the middle class and the working class, but you're not allowed to talk about the authoritarian element. You're not allowed to talk about the terrible precedent that is being set with all of this. You're not allowed to talk about the utter incoherence of the regulations. You're not allowed to talk about how the government was, or at least certain sections of the government, were obviously encouraging these BLM protests, which were in flagrant violation of coronavirus safety guidelines. Like, basically, what happened last year, as far as I could see, it was a psychological war, where the public was being dumbed down, and the public was being subjected to agitprop, the key term there being agitation. They were being driven into a state of effective insanity. So when you talk about the public being driven to argue about something relatively frivolous like face coverings, you can see that the public, their mental faculties are being weakened deliberately by the authoritarian state. And so the dumbing down of America was accelerated exponentially last year. And we're beginning to see the consequences of that now, where people are coming out of their homes for the first time in a year. And you can see that they are just completely insane. I mean, they've just been watching Marvel movies and getting stoned for the last year. And you can see that their cognitive ability has been weakened considerably, perhaps permanently.
Yeah. So another thing I wanted to talk about was the Second Amendment. And you and I have done
Yeah.
At least two or three videos on this, you know, on your channel and my channel.
Should do two or three a day.
Yeah. I think the Second Amendment is completely useless at this point. Yeah. I mean, it serves no purpose anymore. I mean, because the only guys I ever see using the Second Amendment to its potential are the Boogaloo Boys, and they'd never shoot anybody. So, I mean, like, if you're never going to shoot anyone, I'm not really sure what the Second Amendment is good for. And I think that this is another social distraction, sort of like masks. So a lot of constitutionalists, they get hung up on the Second Amendment. Like, that becomes their, if not their number one issue, their only issue, you know. And, it's such a red herring to me. I feel like they want us to believe that they're going to try to confiscate our guns, even though we will never use them against them, ever.
Yeah.
We never will. So if you can scare the constitutionalist crowd into, you know, protecting this one amendment that you're really never going to go after, you can steal everything else, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of the press, you know, literally everything. And they're going to be so focused on their guns that they're not going to notice that literally everything else has been taken away from in front of them. And as you know, I'm a staunch gun rights person. I don't think the government should regulate firearms at all. But I can also realize, it's just like with the masks. I didn't like the masks, but I can realize that there's something bigger afoot here.
Yeah.
And I feel like this constant right-left division that is created by guns is really ultimately a distraction while they just remove the rest of our rights.
Yeah, I saw plenty of bozos at these reopened New Hampshire rallies were standing out there with unloaded AR-15s. So what good is an unloaded AR-15? I mean, you might as well be throwing a stick at somebody. The First Amendment, the people who are the most vocal about the Second Amendment, they don't seem to understand what it actually says, because obviously it does not say that if you don't like your government, you are allowed to storm the Capitol building with firearms. That would be legal incoherence. There's no way that they would actually put something like that in the Constitution and codify it as law. Now, the issue of gun confiscation is obviously completely impractical, because like we were saying earlier about the national debt, there's no way to actually pay off the national debt. At this point, you have all of these unregistered guns, millions upon millions of them permeating the country. There's no way to keep track of it. There is no realistic, coherent program whereby you could confiscate the guns. It would actually be a lot easier and simpler to confiscate all of the cars, because those are all registered, or at least they're supposed to be. And I remember actually back in the fall of 2019, when I started going out on the campaign trail to ask the Democratic candidates about Assange, that's when I first realized how useless the Second Amendment is, because it's very obvious that these people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and all of these other Washington royalty, they obviously don't go out to do their own grocery shopping. They don't go out to run their own errands. So what do they care if there's a mass shooting? I mean, they're not going to be the ones who get caught in the crossfire. It's going to be the servant that they send out to do the shopping on their behalf. So I don't believe that the politicians are actually even worried about gun violence. I don't think that they're concerned about the Second Amendment in that sense, because they're not going to be the victims of it. Their children don't go to the public schools where there's a 1 in 100,000 chance that you might become the victim of a school shooting. Their kids wouldn't be subjected to that. I completely agree that the Second Amendment has become this smokescreen of sorts, kind of like the way the First Amendment has, where the tech companies with their censorship, that is permitted through the First Amendment, and nobody cares. Obviously, the government is never going to get to the point where me having a private conversation in my home is going to be something that's of concern to them, as long as it's not being broadcast on the internet. I think that the legal system in this country is kept deliberately incoherent. And not to go off on this tangent, but I think we saw some of this with the Bill Cosby situation, where with that case, looks like there are some really incompetent people either on the side of the prosecution or on the side of the defense. Nobody understands the law of this country.
Yeah, and I'm not very informed on the Cosby case, but Dak's going to be doing a video that sounds like it's going to get some views, so make sure you go check out his channel. So after the 2020 primaries, you and I found ourselves talking with a lot of progressives because they were the other disenfranchised group because Bernie Sanders had, you know, just had the primary rigged so obviously against him. I think more obviously than last time to the
without question.
So we were, you know, we were talking with a lot of progressives, and I was trying to build coalitions. I was trying to create some sort of situation where we could work together because we're both against this current system that exists. But I just feel that progressives are so lost. You know, I mean, they're so confused right now. They have no idea what they stand for. So I've gone all in on the Libertarian Party. I think the best way that we're going to get progressives to help us is actually if we have a strong libertarian message and they say, hey, you know, these guys are serious. They actually have sort of an idea of what they're going to do, and I like some of it, so I'll go join them. Instead of this idea of trying to create some mishmash of two ideas and putting them together. But what do you think about libertarianism? What do you think about the Libertarian Party? I do want to preface this by saying I do not think the Libertarian Party can win the presidential election and save this country or something. At this point, I think the Libertarian Party is a force for advocating for decentralization, advocating for secession, advocating for leaving each other the hell alone, because as we were discussing earlier, I do believe we're headed toward this place where we're going to have to choose to either decentralize or become way more authoritarian. So I want to, you know, I want to do everything I can to try to push us in the right direction. But what do you think about libertarians? What do you think about the Libertarian Party? Just, I know you were a Ron Paul supporter, so what do you think going forward?
Ron Paul is the one who red-pilled me. It was a weird day. I was working at a pizza parlor, and there was a newspaper lying there in the summer of 2011. I just happened to open it up and look at a column about Ron Paul where he explained his views on drugs and wars and everything else. And I just said, oh, okay, I actually agree with that quite a bit. I'm going to vote for Ron Paul. And seeing the Republican Party screw him out of the nomination was really demoralizing. The thing is, libertarianism will always have, I'll always have my roots in libertarianism because of that. I can agree with things like co-ops and things like that to eliminate a lot of needless burden fetters that we find ourselves stuck with. And I'm not sure about capitalism per se, because I have some questions about the profit margin, but that's a different subject of discussion. The problem Libertarian Party is this. The problem I have with any political party or Paul is it's that it presents the idea that institutional reform is possible, and that's the problem I have with it. Is it's like that was the issue that I had at the end of the day with Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard, was they were sending a message that the Democratic Party could be reformed, which is obviously idiotic. And yeah, looking back on it, you could argue that Ron Paul was doing the same thing when he was running as a Republican. But with the Libertarian Party, it's this. I know you said that you're aware that they're not going to win elections, but I think that nevertheless they give off this impression that internal institutional reform is possible. And I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I did not think last year that it was appropriate for Joe Jorgensen to be soliciting donations during that pandemic. She was asking people for donations of $20.20, which I thought was grossly inappropriate during a pandemic. But also, if we're going to be completely forthcoming and we're going to acknowledge that the Libertarian Party cannot win at the ballot box, then I don't know that they should be soliciting donations. I don't know that that's appropriate. But what I find interesting about the Libertarian Party is how it is far more popular than the Green Party, but the media and the establishment refuse to admit it. Jill Stein was castigated all day long for supposedly throwing the election to Donald Trump. And yet Gary Johnson, who was not by any means a serious intellectual libertarian, he got almost three times as many votes as she did, if I'm not mistaken. but the media never mentioned him. And I think it's because libertarianism is more dangerous to the state than progressivism, because progressivism can be hijacked and co-opted in order to give the government even more power while it expands its tyrannical reach. Yet libertarianism would accomplish exactly the opposite. So that's why I think the state and the establishment, they just try to suppress dialogue about libertarianism in a way that they don't seem to be nearly as afraid of progressivism.
Mm-hmm. So what if the Libertarian Party, because I would agree with you, in the past, the Libertarian Party has had this mantra of, we're going to take over the government and leave you alone, which is ridiculous. I mean, you can't take over a government by being anti-government. I mean, it can't be done. What if the Libertarian Party really becomes a force that is just for removing government power, that just admits, like, the state is not the way to fix things. The only way to fix things is through direct action and through, reforming things and bringing things back to bringing things back to a local level and abolishing all these institutions. Is it something that you would take more seriously?
Yeah, I think the Libertarian Party would be great if it was rebranded as like a communications company, where it's creating its own news channels, it's creating its own publishing venues, it's creating a digital space for the expression of libertarian ideas. That's where I think it would be a most effective. And I could get on board with that, because I am becoming skeptical of the... I'm becoming skeptical of progressivism as a standalone philosophy. I don't think it actually qualifies. And I do have a desire to return to my libertarian roots. But I think that any type of political party, any type of personal campaign where it's a representative, to go back to Mike Gravel, a person who claims to represent the people, I think that the campaign is going to be subject to a number of inherent unavoidable evils. One of the big ones is the cult of personality. If you're running as a candidate, you're going to have a cult of personality develop around you. And that means you're lying to your fans to a certain degree. And that's not good. So, yeah, I think that if we're going to be honest, to see the Libertarian Party focus more on creating a space for communication and the expression and dissemination of libertarian ideals, that to me would be more laudable than this semblance of a political institution.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's value to getting politicians into office, but not necessarily to reform things. You know, I think Ron Paul's influence was mostly his platform that he had. I think the same about Justin Amash. Like, his last several months in office, he was just exposing the ridiculousness that was going on in Congress. You know, things weren't really debated. They were voted on pretty much party lines. Thomas Massey, with his demand that the CARES Act be voted for with a recorded vote, things like that, they have more of an impact on the public than they do on the government. And this is why you and I have so much disdain for Rand Paul as opposed to Ron Paul, because Rand Paul, even though his voting record is pretty good for the most part, he butchers it when it comes to his platform, where Ron Paul was always advocating the message and, you know, making a point to the American people in everything he did. In my mind, at least on a federal level, that's what the goal of the Libertarian Party should be. So you can still try to win a Senate seat. You can still run someone for president. But the point of that should be to draw attention to the issues at hand and show the American people what's going on. The only type of institutional reform I could see at all would be at like the state house level, where it's so localized, where you know, you may have a little bit of control, but as far as trying to take over Congress, take over the White House, I think that's a joke.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think it's helpful in the sense that I think it's helpful for people who need to be red-pilled. Like, I think it's helpful at an elementary level, where when Ron Paul ran the second time, or the third time, technically, I was 19 years old. I was not red-pilled. I was not very much informed. It was helpful to have this man with his political success as a representative speaking about these issues, it gave them a certain credibility. And I think that was the benefit to progressives with Bernie Sanders, was to have a man of his stature talking about Medicare for All and things like that. I think it gives them credibility. Tulsi Gabbard with the anti-war stuff, it gives credibility. I recognize that. But I suppose the problem, which it's maybe it's more my personal problem than it is a societal or institutional problem, is that to me, I no longer have any use for that sort of thing. There probably will be a woke or unplugged candidate running on the Republican side for president in 2024, but I'm not going to waste any time supporting that person because I've seen this movie too many times before. And so it's like, maybe there's some kid out there who needs to be unplugged from the matrix who will benefit from seeing that virtuous Republican collapse in 3 years, but I'm kind of on a different page. You're kind of on a different page. So I guess it's just, maybe I'm just sort of focusing on myself a bit here, but I do think that I don't have any use for that sort of process anymore. That's something I've kind of moved beyond.
Gotcha. Well, it was a good conversation, Dak.
Yes.
We'll have to do more of these coming up like we used to. I've got a link to your channel and to your website in the description.
Oh,
but if there's any other plugs you want to drop or anything else you want to say, we'll do that now and then we'll end the show.
No, just if we can get like 12 more people to subscribe to my channel, I'll hit 1,000 subscribers and it will have taken only 2 years to get it done. But yeah, we're trying to do the comeback for Overwritten because I was very close to retiring just for a lot of different reasons, but we're trying to get the comeback going. And I should have an article out published tomorrow about Derek Chauvin, Bill Cosby, and Julian Assange. And then we'll have a video on that sometime next week. So looking forward to people unsubscribing after I finally hit 1,000.
You guys will never get bored listening to Dak. So head over to his channel, check it out. He's got lots of great videos. I just did a debate on capitalism versus socialism on his channel that I shared with a lot of you guys. Go check that out. Go subscribe. Go follow him on Overwritten. Dak, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Reed.